And here we are again on a Tuesday night. Welcome to the Mead House. We got a lot to talk about tonight, so purposely I didn't do the Facebook thing here tonight like I usually do. I apologize for that. I know a lot of folks out there probably like to hear their name mentioned on the show, but I promise we'll catch up next week. I want to welcome Ryan Richardson to the show here tonight. Ryan was listening, or has been listening to our show, called in the show here a couple of weeks ago, was talking about the Braggots. Ryan's got a lot to contribute here, and we've invited him in, as part of the crew here at the Mead House. So he's sitting at the table tonight. Aaron Martin in the house, Mississippi, Chris Spencer. He's taking up his place, and Jeff Douse in the house. I'm J.D. Webb, and again, this is the Mead House. Now, if you think you want to give us a holler, go right ahead. That number is 818-921-4680 if you happen to be listening live. If not, hey, you can email the show. Go to the website, themeadhouse.com. Hit that Contact Us deal up there at the top. Shoot us an email. And we'll be glad to answer questions, or if you want to come on the show, make arrangements, or whatever's on your mind. So, geez, guys, here we go again, Tuesday night. Everything's working. What do you think?
That's so far, so good.
Yeah, you know, I spent so much time on this equipment, and, you know, it's funny. You know, we have a good show one night. I turn everything off. Nothing changes. And then until the following Tuesday night, I, you know, flip the switches, turn everything back on, and then all hell breaks loose. So, go figure.
I'm still hearing the music, baby.
Yeah, it'll be gone. There we go. It was supposed to have faded out, and I forgot to hit another button. So that one was actually my fault.
That would have made us sound professional for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is, you know, the software that we're using here on the Mead House is like regular radio station software. It I mean, you can load up commercials to play at certain times and the whole nine yards. And I had another piece of music queued up in the other deck. So when it rolls out of one deck, it rolls into the next deck. And I had forgotten that that piece of music, that title, was still sitting up there. So that being said, Ryan, we usually go around the table here and figure out what we're all drinking tonight. I'll start off tonight. I'm drinking Ménage à Trois. I don't get any funny ideas either. This is a wine. This is a red wine. It's called Ménage à Trois Midnight. And I've been drinking this stuff for a couple of months now. I found it at, I think it was at the supermarket. And it's just a California red blend. It's a table wine. And it's got a really nice, dark, fruity, oaky flavor to it that I really fell in love with, and I really like this stuff. So Ménage à Trois, that's what's in my glass tonight. So let's scoot it on around the table. Mississippi, what kind of coffee is that I smell?
Oh, it's 8 o'clock dark Italian roast.
That dark Italian roast. Hey, yeah. Good stuff. Now you you do the cream and cream and sugar, just or cream. Just cream. All right,
just so. Cream. Yeah, but I do the real deal. No, none of the fake powder stuff. This is real heavy cream.
So it comes out like a latte, or what do they call them thing?
No, it's just a hot coffee with cream, and it's it's good.
I know you're not a bourbon drinker, but, you know, what about, you know, a little rum, a little extra something? No?
Not tonight, no, but no, I'm not opposed to that at all at most times.
A little homemade Kahlua?
Yes, sir. A little Bailey's or something.
There you go. That works.
Yeah. Creamy.
Yeah. All right. Scooting on around the table here. Aaron Martin, what's in your cup, my friend?
So tonight I actually am just on the heels here coming back from a little mini vacation to Tallahassee, Florida. Met up with my old roommate from college, and we like to do a little beer exchange from time to time. I ship him some Wisconsin beers.
Wisconsin beers, I heard that. Did we lose Aaron? Did we lose everybody?
I'm still here.
I'm here.
I'm still here.
What happened to Aaron?
We lost Aaron. He had
One too many Wisconsin beers. Yeah, I show I'm still connected here, but let's take it on over to Ryan. Ryan, you drinking anything tonight?
Yeah, I actually do a beer exchange with a buddy in Michigan, although he sent me a beer from Ohio. I am drinking a bourbon barrel-aged barley wine. It's got some nice toffee and hazelnut notes and lots of charred oak and vanilla. It's coming in at 11.9 ABV and 101 wow. IBUs.
Wow.
That is some powerful, powerful stuff.
Yeah, I should, JD, get into any shout-outs at the beginning, but I feel this beer deserves one. So, Christian Shale, if you're not listening now, I'm going to send you the podcast, and thanks for the beer, buddy.
There you go. Wow. Almost makes me want to go to Michigan and get me one. Aaron, are you back with us?
Back with you. Sorry about that. I got disconnected there.
That's okay. You were going on about doing a beer exchange, and then I think that's all we heard.
Yeah, so fresh off the heels here of a trip down to Tallahassee, Florida, and my roommate down there from college, we like to do a beer exchange. So I'll send him some beers from Wisconsin, some New Glarus and Sprecher and stuff like that, and then he'll send me some stuff from down south. And he sent me some Cigar City beers. This is a brewery out of Tampa, Florida, and this is their IPA. It's called Hyalai, 7.5% ABV and 70 international bitterness units. And for those of you that have listened before, you know I am a hop head for sure. I love IPAs, so this is definitely right up my alley.
Yeah. I think maybe for a Christmas present, I'm going to send you about 4 pounds of hops. One of those, what do you call those, potpourri things, put it in a nice little pretty little bag with a bow on it. You can just set it in your living room. And
there you go. There you go. Some
smell.
What did you call that? Potpourri
or whatever the hell they call it.
I've never heard it called that before. A little hop puree. How about that?
Hey, I'm a dude. You know, I don't do that kind of stuff.
Those California accents, pot pourri.
Oh, I just figured JD's always laying into Chris for his pronunciations of like oil and oh. This and that. So we gotta lay into you a little bit this time.
I got one on him now. Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff, I know you've always got something interesting in your glass. What are you drinking tonight?
Tonight I am drinking a 2.5-year-old Sizer, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and there's a couple of reasons for this. One reason, of course, we're talking about Sizers tonight, so, keep it topical. The other reason is this is actually made by one of the first guys that I ever taught the craft. It was one of his first brews. And this guy is actually getting married, not this weekend, but next weekend. So a little way to memorialize that event, too, since this will be, out in the ether for eons and eons afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. How does it taste?
That's pretty good. It's got a heck of a kick to it still. You get a big expression of apple. You get a big expression of honey. It's kind of... It's very flavor forward.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. Sounds good. Last week, we started getting into this Sizer thing, and you know, I know I may have kicked it off a little earlier, but I mean, I think it depends on when apple season kind of starts, you know, where you live or where different folks live around the country. And for me, you know, it's pretty much going to be starting here momentarily. You know, this is the beginning of October. It'll start kicking in here in a few more weeks. I'm sure the orchards will start opening up out east of me. We took some, you know, during the after show last week, we got to talking about some different things, and I was trying to take some notes and get them into the show notes as quickly as I could while we were sitting there talking. And I have cider yeast up here with a couple of question marks. I'm not quite sure what we were talking about at that point. I didn't record, like I usually record the after show part, but I didn't record that one. So I don't know, Chris, cider yeast, or did I mean sizer yeast, or what were we talking about? I know that you had said, you know, when it comes to using, you know, apple juice, anything with apples, that the D-Series Lauvin products are pretty good. The 21s, 10s, D47, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've always liked those. They're not quite as fast to drink as 71B or something that's designed for like a nouveau wine or something. But the D series works really well with cider or sizer. I think the discussion we were having was just a general discussion about what we like to use, and the fact that either Jeff or Aaron. One brought up that there's actually a cider kit that comes with a some sort of, I think maybe you said US05 or something. I know a lot of people who make ciders, like hard ciders, may use some of the beer yeast. I think Jeff brought that up.
Yeah, the beer yeast is a popular one, from what I understand, US05 or SO4. I think US05 is probably the predominantly popular one. And a lot of the cider kits will actually come with a proprietary strain of their own cider, at least the ones that I've used before. I think it's Cider House is the brand name.
You know, in preparation for this, I got on YouTube and was looking around at some different hard cider videos, seeing what I could pick up as far as little tidbits here and there. And I noticed a lot of the US05 being used. And see, there was another one. I think it was maybe Y Yeast that actually makes a cider yeast as well. It's either those or Y Labs. It's a liquid yeast.
Yeah, Y Yeast makes a cider yeast, yeah.
Yeah. And but I've been picking up some little notes here and there, and it seems like a lot of people are making turbo cider, which is basically just apple juice with a lot of sugar added to boost up the alcohol. Of course, that depends on using a yeast that can carry it high as you want it. But I'm thinking, you know, this really translates over a lot with a sizer where you just use honey instead of sugar. And which is basically sort of what we do what I've been doing with a sizer. But as far as the yeast goes, I think it really determines, it depends on how fast you want to be able to drink this thing. You know, the D series, D21, D47, and of course then you got DV10, which is going to take it a little bit higher ABV. Those are really good incisors and ciders too, but they just take a little bit longer to get ready, whereas like a 71B will be drinkable sooner. So and then that's considering you do everything right, keep your temperature under control and everything. So, you know, I always leave some leeway there. I've been using the D series. I think this year I'm going to use 71B just because I've decided on a recipe that Michael Fairbrother does with his apple pie. And he uses 71D for it. So I think if I'm going to steal his recipe, then I might as well use the same yeast.
There you go.
I've got two drawers full of 71D, so
yeah,
might as well use it.
You mentioned that, and I probably watched all the same videos you did on YouTube, and I've scoured YouTube for all kinds of stuff. And, the one thing, I mean, you mentioned this turbo cider, and I suppose you could probably do the same thing, like you said, with honey, turning it into a sizer. But, the only part I don't like about that is it's going to run the alcohol up, but isn't that going to kind of detract? I mean, you're talking about a long wait time at that point, I think, because it's kind of detract from the apple flavor a bit, I would think, when you run the alcohol up that high, you think, or am I out on the field?
Well, I think so, but any in my experience, any sizer that's fairly new is going to be almost void of any apple flavor anyway for a while. We talked about the Braggots, how it seemed like Braggots take a little while to come around, and sizers are somewhat the same way. You know, they just take a while. It's not the kind of thing that you can just make and drink in 6 weeks and or at least I've not been able to. There may be someone out there who can do it, but I haven't been able to enjoy one in 2 or 3 months and say this is a sizer or this is what a sizer should be. They just take a while. And of course, the better your mead making practices, the faster they're ready, it seems like. But there's something about the fermentation process that really does a number on apple flavor for some reason.
Yeah. We had talked about in our after show last week about apple concentrate, adding it after the fact, in secondary to try to enhance the apple flavor. But that's, you kind of got to be careful with that too, don't you?
It's certainly a way to do it.
Go ahead, Ryan.
Go ahead.
I was going to say I've done that after stabilizing, so not necessarily while it's in secondary fermentation, but once you've stabilized the cider, to use that concentrate as a back sweetener and apple flavor enhancer.
Yeah, because that concentrate's, I mean, it's loaded up with sugar too, right? So you certainly don't want that firing off again and kind of a moot point after that. I mean,
this does bring to mind something that I'd read about recently and been kind of interested to try, despite it being labor intensive sounding. The idea of ice cider.
What they
do is essentially they freeze the apple juice and then let it slowly thaw. The sugary parts are going to melt first because of just the way and the chemical nature of it. So if you melt off something like 70% of that apple juice, it's going to be more concentrated in sugar. You do that over and over again, and you get a much higher sugar content, must or wort or whatever you call proto cider. In the end, you get more alcohol content from it.
I wonder. Talk about the extraction process. How many half-gallon jugs, how many quarts or half-gallon or even gallons at that point would it take to be able to do that, I wonder, to get enough
That's an operant question. The thing that comes to my mind, though, is we could easily do a poor man's replication of this process by just adding some apple juice concentrate into primary.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's another point we talked about after the show last week was the concentrate can be added in primary as well as secondary to increase apple flavor. And in a way, it's really not cheating because, if we had real cider apples, we would probably have a lot more flavor to start with anyway.
Yeah.
So in a way, we're just sort of making up for having inferior juice to start with. So,
yeah.
But then again, who, you know, there's the cider police are not going to come if you decide you want to do that anyway. So it's not really cheating if it tastes good, is it?
Well, no. I mean, that's kind of the whole point. I mean, I don't make this stuff for anybody else's taste buds but mine, and we're going to talk about that later on too. But you know, mine and my wife's. But you know, I mean, like you were saying, Chris. I mean, this is you know, I live out here in California. I mean, this is you know, where I live is not apple country. I have to go 70 miles east to get into the orchards that are anywhere near me. And so, you know, a lot of the times, you're left buying whatever is available in a store. That's going to be the labeled, concentrated, apple juices. The Tree Time or the Mott's apple juice or Langer's or, you know, whatever it might be in your neck of the woods. So, you know, trying to maximize the flavor of the apples because you don't even know what kind of apples you're getting in that juice. You know it's going to be a blend, you know.
Yeah, and you know Jeff's point about the freeze concentrating is probably not a bad idea to look into because you can really have a hell of a time trying to find concentrate that doesn't have some sort of preservative in it. And most often it's going to be sorbate, which if you're wanting to look, you know, if you're looking to put it in primary, well, that's pretty much a deal breaker if it has sorbate in it. So,
well, the concentrates, there's one, there's actually a, well, actually out in your neck of the woods, Chris, Kroger. There's a Kroger brand apple concentrate that in the frozen part of the, you know, in the frozen section, that you can use. It's not, there's no preservatives, or nothing. It's just frozen apple concentrate.
Yep. And you know, actually, I've got a can in the freezer. Let me see what I've got and what it has in it.
Yeah. The one that I get out here at our local Ralph's store, it's got the blue Kroger label on it, and it's just plain old apple concentrate, nothing in it, no sugars, no nothing. It's just apple concentrate. I think it's the same.
Well, actually, this one is it only has ascorbic acid, which is just vitamin C. This one is called Old Orchard. 100% juice, apple concentrate, and no, it doesn't have sorbate either. So I guess I got lucky when I bought this.
Yeah.
I don't even know why I bought it.
For your sizer.
But that's probably what it was, yeah.
Put a post-it note on it. Don't touch.
Oh, I know what it was. I know what happened. I bought the Old Orchard orange concentrate when I did the orange, the chocolate orange mead, and I accidentally picked up an apple because I just grabbed a whole handful of the orange and there was an apple in it. So that's what happened.
There you go.
So I've already got an apple concentrate here, and it has no sorbate, so I'm good to go.
Good to go. So, you know, what we're talking about here now is either primary or secondary. You know, obviously in primary, it's going to chew through whatever sugars that are in there, but it's going to leave behind maybe a concentrated apple flavor for you. And then, you know, if you choose to put it in secondary after a sorbate, stabilize it. You know, still able to maximize some apple flavor, but you're also going to be adding, you know, a limited amount of sweetness, you know, to it as well. So I guess it kind of, what is it, what do they call that? Eye of the beholder type of deal where, you know, whatever it is you're looking for. So,
yeah, and for almost all sizers that I do, just because I know someone's going to ask, I like the final gravity to be around 10-20. And that's just my personal taste, but it seems like it just really fits almost everything with a sizer.
Yeah.
I know some people like them bone dry. And that's fine too, if that's what you like. But
take that around the table. Where's your magic, your sweet spot on the hydrometer there with a sizer?
To be honest with you, I've never made a sizer. This will be my first season making them. So,
any idea where you want it to stop or?
I'm thinking on the drier side, maybe like 10-10. I like a dry cider, so I would assume I would like a dry sizer as well. But I may surprise myself.
Ryan, you've made some sizers in the past, right?
Yeah. I don't have my book in front of me to tell you what the final gravity was, but I prefer them on the dry end as well. I just in general prefer things dry. If you're looking for a commercial cider example, one of my favorites is a British one called Blackthorn, and it's a very dry, British cider.
Yeah, perfect. That's the way I like them. Aaron, any preferences?
Good question. I think last week I may have said that I hadn't ever had a sizer before, and after thinking about it some more, I have had the apple pie, which is Michael Fairbrother's sizer that Chris has mentioned. And that one, I don't know where that is on in terms of a final gravity, but it's definitely a little bit more on the sweet side, which I definitely liked. It's hard for me to say. I mean, I think I would definitely like a drier cider as well, semi-sweet. Probably I would enjoy all of them. And if I were going to make one here, I would probably shoot for like the semi-sweet range, maybe a 10-15, 10-17, somewhere in that range probably.
Yeah. You mentioned, I don't want to get Chris's input on this too, but I mean, you mentioned this apple pie thing, and this is if you're going to throw like this apple pie or caramel apple or whatever, shouldn't you be looking at a higher sugar content? I mean, you're looking for a sweeter mead, or do you think these kinds of spices, apple pie spices, what are we looking at? Allspice, cinnamon, nutmeg, that kind of thing. Do they actually work in a dry sizer, Chris?
I'm sure they would. I've never done it though. And actually, the Michael's recipe for the apple pie is nothing more than cinnamon and vanilla. He's got a vanilla bean and cinnamon stick, and that's it. Yeah. And it's very, very simple to do. That's why I had suggested it when we talked about doing sort of a group brew sizer this year.
Yeah.
Of course, we've got all sorts of options. If you guys like something drier, then you might want to, we might want to consider doing something else, but, when I think apple pie, obviously it's going to be a little bit sweet. And I think a sweetness in a sizer helps to bring out some of that apple flavor that's lost too. So, like Ryan said, talking about back sweetening using apple concentrate, that's a good way to get your sweetness back and increase some of the apple flavor as well. Just the fact that you're sweetening it up is going to give the perception of more apple flavor.
Something else I had here in my notes as well. If you're going to be using, I don't know that this would be I guess it would be the case for any kind of apple juice. I would think the real deal, fresh pressed, would probably be more susceptible, but. We were talking about oxidizing and how it would be notorious for that, which is kind of a dangerous thing, really. So, what do we do about that? How do we keep it from oxidizing?
Keep your juice. Yeah, you keep your juice as fresh as possible. Use it as fast as possible if it's fresh pressed, and everything else is just good careful mead making practices. Don't splash it around. Don't let it sit in the fermenter any longer than it has to. But oxidation with a sizer, it can be a good thing and a bad thing, a lot like cherries. You know, cherry melomels, I think we talked about that a little bit of oxidation is not really a bad thing. In fact, it can really help a cherry melomel some. And there are certain things you do with sizers where a little bit of oxidation can help as well. Way back at the beginning, we had the discussion on oxidative and reductive ferments. And if you remember, when we talked about reductive qualities, we talked about like the rotten cabbage type flavors that you can get, sort of smells like old trash almost. Now, with a sizer, anything with an apple, it has it tends to have a higher sulfide production anyway. So you're going to get some sulfur smells, especially during active fermentation. Now, if you couple that with a reductive ferment, you've got something that's really hideous. So sometimes a little oxidation in a sizer is a lot like a cherry melomel. It can actually be a good thing to help drive off some of that sulfur that's produced during fermentation.
Yeah.
You know, so like everything else for all the nerds out there, it's nothing's as simple as it seems on the surface. There's always some science involved.
Well, yeah. And
but with that said, the point you were making was that sizers are very, very easily oxidized, more so even than melomels. Think about cutting an apple in half. Cut an apple in half, sit it on the counter, and see how long it takes before it starts to turn brown. That brown color is oxidation taking place. So apples oxidize very fast.
Yeah, like 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know what? There's I kind of ran into this idea while I was at a Total Wine store. Actually, it was a BevMo. I saw this can of CO2. It's an aerosol can, and it looks like a hairspray can. And I picked it up, and I thought it was empty. So I picked another one up, and it felt the same way. It didn't dawn on me that it's nothing but compressed air. So, there really isn't any weight to it at all. But I brought it home thinking, I can top up that headspace, between the bung and the surface of the liquid in my carboy, when I get them into secondary. And that's what I do. I buy a couple of these. They're like, $8 or $9. And I squirt a little bit in the in headspace and slam the bung down on the top, and I'm good to go. So that's another idea to
You have a new toy now. You don't have to do that anymore.
I don't have to do that anymore.
You've got the Blickman beer gun, so you can just purge your airspace and you're done.
That's true. My new toy came a few days ago, and I haven't used it yet. It's still sitting there in a box. I took it all out just to make sure all the parts and everything were there. But I'm kind of eager to use that. So, the other thing I had in the notes, we're talking sizers here, was Chris, you had mentioned this is kind of the Mississippi Chris show tonight, I guess.
I'm tired.
You were talking that lees aging with a sizer is not necessarily a bad thing either, because it can add a little body to the sizer to the mead.
Yeah, and I need to give credit here where credit is due. I got this whole idea of lees aging with sizers from Oscar, or we know him as Pete Backlish.
Yeah, yeah.
I got the whole idea from him from a recipe that he posted, one of his blueberry sizers. And basically there was two stages to it. There was actually a gross lees aging, and then there was the more traditional lees aging. The first stage is where you go through your primary fermentation, and you've got your blueberries mixed in with your must and crushed. Primary fermentation finishes, and then you leave it alone for about 3 months. Leave it in your primary fermenter. You don't do anything to it. Just let it sit.
Okay.
And what that does is it extracts tannins from the blueberries. It extracts color, and it extracts some body from the yeast as they begin to decompose. After about 2 to 3 months, then you will rack off of the sediment, but you intentionally bring some of the yeast cake with you into secondary, not the berries, but the yeast.
Yeah.
Now, this is where the traditional lees aging starts, and this is done with wines, especially some white wines and things, where you stir it once a week for the first 4 weeks, and then you leave it alone. Then there's nothing else to do but just let it sit.
Yeah.
And as the yeast cells begin to decompose and rupture, they'll release different sorts of saccharides. And these saccharides add body and mouthfeel to the sizer, which most sizers and ciders both are lacking somewhat in mouthfeel. With a cider, you don't really want that because it's that light body that really makes them crisp and refreshing. With a sizer, which is a lot more wine-like, it's better to have a little body to them.
Sure.
In most cases, I mean, this is comes back to style, but that can really help that type of sizer. And that was one of the recipes that Pete had posted, and I have yet to make it, but I fully intend to make that recipe because I can picture what it's going to be like, and you know, we might even get his permission and consider doing that one pretty soon.
Yeah. Well, I know Aaron doesn't have to worry about that because he's going to probably chuck in a handful of hops on top of his, so.
Most likely.
Our resident hop head. Well.
Hey, you guys, I do have just one question about sizers and cider making in general. On average, just a like fresh pressed apple cider, what's the typical gravity of that going to run? Is it, you know, is it on the medium side, about high 1050. Side? Where, about 1050. Okay.
Yeah, about 1050 is what I have found. I don't, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a hit or a miss, depending on what kind of apple, you know, plus or minus 5 or 10.
Yeah, but, it's going to be in that range.
Yeah, somewhere around 1050. Yeah.
So do you guys think that there's less variation in the gravity of a fresh-pressed apple cider versus the gravity that you would get in a honey must, assuming you have the same amount of water and honey, like different types of honey?
Good question.
Mm.
Ryan, any ideas?
Yeah, that is a good question. You know, I think to go back a half step, it really depends on, I think, the type of apples, the type of blend you're using that might be adjusting that sugar. For me, I've also noticed now I've used maybe a half dozen different types of honey. And they've all been within, you know, maybe a couple thousandths of a point, you know, when you're using the, you know, 1 pound of honey or, you know, of each different variety when you're making your must. So, you know, I'm not the scientist on it, but it seems to be that nature's got a way of getting things kind of within a ballpark.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, one of the reasons I'm asking, I don't know if this is something that you guys have ever encountered or heard, but in some of the local orchards that we have here, you'll hear things just from the people that work there, like at the farm, that if you have like a frost or, you know, some freezing weather overnight type of a thing, that can like intensify the sweetness or the flavor of the apple. So
that is absolutely true. You'll see that in the wines. The most common wine style I can think of is ice Riesling or frosted Riesling, whatever kind of creative name they want to come. And that's, they'll wait until the grapes actually have a frost and then ferment them to extract, they give a little more sugar that way. I don't know. Or convert a little more of their fruit into sugars for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I was kind of going back to what Jeff was talking about, you know, throwing apple juice in the freezer and freezing it. I mean, same kind of a principle. You're going to get a very concentrated, sweeter, solution. So.
Wineries
don't like to capitalize their juice if they can help it.
No, I mean not unless they're going after like Ryan's of a particular style of wine, mm-hmm. You know, Rieslings are somewhat on the sweet side to begin with. So, but we were talking Patty Mackey, who's an avid listener. We had her on the show here a few weeks back. Month ago, maybe, but she's an avid listener, and of course she's been listening to our series on the Braggot thing, and we had talked about. I had a question. I guess we were talking about, and it might have been my question about how much does honey contribute to the hydrometer when you're looking at, you know, adding more sugar to the Braggot. And this might be true even with the sizes, but she's saying, now granted, I mean, this isn't anything scientific either, so don't quote 35 points, but she says honey adds roughly 35 points per pound to the hydrometer. So, for instance, per gallon, yeah. So she says her example is a 5-gallon kit with a starting gravity of 1065, would actually be about 1.107 with 6 pounds of honey added. So, but that 35 points, that also depends on the honey variety, the sweetness level in the honey. As Chris can atone to the wildflower that I have here at my house, it is some of the super sweetest honey you've ever had. So it may be higher than that. It may be 40 points.
I think that honey could easily get 38 or 40 points per pound and per gallon, and whereas some of the local stuff I have here would probably be pushing it to get 28 points per gallon. So,
yeah, and that's, you can use that as a rough starting point if you're trying to, you know, figure out how much honey you want to throw in. I mean, you know, you're going to start out somewhere around 1050 if you just wanted to, you know, pencil it out before you started mixing anything, before you get the hydrometer wet. You could probably do the math, come up with a kind of a roundabout figure, kind of a, you know, give you some idea of what you're looking at, and then, of course, you know, fine-tune it when you get your hydrometer wet and, you know, start doing it, for real. So
that was a good point. I'd like to just, you know, little thing of wisdom here, pearl of wisdom, and this is a very, very general statement, but from what JD and I have talked about and exchanged honeys and different things, our general consensus has been that West Coast honeys are higher in sugar, more concentrated in sugar than East Coast honeys.
Yeah.
And that's not a hard and fast rule by any means, but I think it's probably a good assumption for the most part. And I'm not claiming to have used every honey that I can get from all over the country, but no. I've used a lot of them, and that has been my general experience. So,
we kind of came up with a very reasonable sounding, unscientific, unproven reason for it, and a lot of that has to do with temperature, humidity, and general weather conditions. So,
if I can add some corroborating evidence there, I went to a few weeks ago to visit some friends in Alberta, Canada, and got some of their honey. And obviously, colder climate. I found when I was mixing stuff with it, actually, it took closer to 4 pounds to get an 11-20 mix for gravity wise. When I'm used to about 3 and some change here. So I think the water content of their honey is definitely higher than what I find around here. And I do totally buy that it's a climate difference.
Yeah.
I think the drier, more arid, less humidity environment out in California and the West Coast, I think the bees are just able to dry it and get more of the moisture out of it than they are here. Of course, now that might change drastically if you get up into Oregon and Washington where it's a lot of rain
and stuff
a lot. So there's going to be exceptions, but as a general, just a very broad statement, East Coast honeys tend to be lower in sugar than West Coast honeys. So you can keep that in mind if you're trying to figure out how much honey to buy.
Yeah. I think, as we move through the sizer thing, last time we were talking, I don't remember if I mentioned it on the show or if it was during the after show thing, but one experiment that I was going to do was to get a gallon of apple juice, some fresh pressed, and then pick up an apple. I'll have to go out to the orchards. My wife and I are planning on going out, and I won't do this experiment for at least about a month and a half or so. When we go out to the orchards, because I want to get an apple that's been untouched, unwashed, right off the tree, and bring it home. But I want to pick up a gallon of fresh pressed juice and just cut the apple up and throw the apple into a carboy, just a glass carboy, and just put an airlock on it and let it sit. And if it takes off and starts fermenting, then I'll know that the yeast that may have been in the juice itself and on the apple is responsible, and just let it go and just, take it until it quits and see what happens. The other thing I was going to do too is I'm thinking about my sizer project. I haven't nailed down a recipe, but I was thinking about using half and half, half store-bought juice and half fresh pressed juice. I don't know what that's going to get me. But hey, like we always say on the show, I mean, if you don't try it at least once, you'll never know, right? That's what this is all about. I have no idea what yeast I'm going to use yet. I know that I want to take it somewhat dry. I want to put it, I want to carbonate it. So that's the direction that I'm headed. So I guess with everybody except for Chris, I know Chris, I mean, come on, you're from the South, sweet tea, the whole nine yards. I know where you're going with your sizer. The rest of us seated at the table, I think, are kind of leaning more towards the dry side, it sounds like. But I would be eager to taste some of Chris's sizer as well. Jeff, you had...
it's got alcohol in it. Of course you want to taste it.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Jeff, you were out of town a while. You came back with some honey. We were laughing last time. What did you say? A barrel full of honey?
I came back with about 25 pounds. Yeah.
You got something going on with that too. Explain.
Well, I'm playing with all kinds of stuff here. It is really interesting stuff. I mean, it's water white. It's thinner than honey that I'm used to.
Now, water white. Are you talking clear, like in water, or are you talking a white color?
I should say the state that I saw it pour out of the vat or out of the spinner, because they harvested it from their own hides. Yeah. It looked like it was a kind of an opaque white, kind of that off-white creamy color you get from melted butter.
So kind of a milky white color then.
Yeah, not okay. white, but definitely not a honey color that I'm used to.
Yeah, okay.
It's a really pretty, pretty honey. Okay. It's a different sweetness profile than the Kansas wildflower that I'm used to. It's not necessarily sweeter, but sweet in a different way that I'm having trouble like putting my finger on.
Yeah.
So I've got a few different, you know, I'm kind of putting it through its paces, if you will. I got some of my favorite recipes, like a hop mead going and a hibiscus mead going. Trying some different stuff as far as I did a Boucher with it, and the Boucher is crazy. If you guys have done Bouchers before, my previous experience with these is like you mix the honey into the must, and it's pretty opaque. You really can't see through it. It doesn't do much. This is bright red.
Wow.
And it catches the light and everything. And I took this honey to like molasses brown, dark.
Wow.
So, yeah, no, it's an interesting experience to play with something very different than I'm used to. It's a lot of fun too.
Yeah. And you're gonna, let's see, I'm reading my notes here. You're gonna do a session strength sizer with that honey.
Yeah, I think I want to do another kind of Boucher style and do a session strength sizer with this. And then I've got some, I talked about before, I have some Wisconsin basswood honey that I picked up a while back too. And it went great in my Braggot. I think I'm going to try a sizer with that as well.
Yeah,
and you know, I can't get around the thought of doing caramelizing some honey for this sizer as well. I mean, if I'm going to do the apple pie, you know, what an apple pie is baked, so
I just
can't get around the thought of not caramelizing some of it.
That's
a likely change I'm going to end up making.
It sounds like it would make a great addition with any kind of honey, but this stuff is really the must before it fermented very much. I tasted some of it just because, you know, it's part of the process. You got to make sure it tastes good, and I kid you not, it tasted exactly like a soft caramel chew.
Oh wow!
Wow! So, like,
and what kind
caramel
of
and apples? It's a wildflower from whatever they've got up there. It says it's predominantly a dandelion, whatever other like floral sources are growing up there.
But JD, we may have to arrange a shipment exchange here.
Yeah, to get after some of that barrel of honey that he's got.
You're gonna have to be quick about it. I've got most of this in fermenters already. But I think I'm going to have to be arranging another trip up there. I'm having so much fun with this stuff, man.
Oh, I can't remember if it was on the show or whether it was in the after thing, but you said something about having a barrel of honey, and I'm thinking, holy crap, I'm coming to Kansas, dude. And I'm bringing a bucket. You're also doing, guy. You know what? Maybe I should just whisper this. You're also doing a pumpkin thing.
Yep. You know, so many friends have been bullying me to do this pumpkin spice thing, not least of
good luck. Good luck.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I can't remember her name for the life of me, but a few episodes back, I gave a shout out to somebody on Facebook that had a solution to this problem. Instead of using actual pumpkin, she used pumpkin tea. I'm not taking that route. I've got some ideas that I'm putting together, and I'm hoping it's going to come out okay. But it's going to be I have a feeling this one's still going to require some aging.
Yeah. My experience with the pumpkin thing, as much as I really wanted it to come out, because I like a nice pumpkin pie. It's not my favorite, but I'll eat it. I remember my grandmother's and my aunt's, pumpkin pies at Christmas time and Thanksgiving. And I like my pumpkin beer, that actually has pumpkin in it, but I think I'm starting to taste the pumpkin, but I can't be 100% sure. I know that it added kind of a creaminess to the texture. It's not real heavy, but it's not a real light, mouthfeel. So I got a funny feeling that's coming from the pumpkin. But that being said, I'm almost thinking, Jeff, that you could do without the pumpkin and just use the pumpkin spice, because that's what everybody tastes anyway.
Yes. And, let me go on record here, and I'm sure this will incite some hate mail, but I am not a fan of pumpkin. I am not a fan of pumpkin pie.
No,
I am not a fan of pumpkin pie
either. I don't care that much for pumpkin either, but I will say this. I think JD is right about the spices. That's what people associate with the flavor, because there's people here in the South. The big thing here is sweet potato pie, and you can make a sweet potato pie and an apple pie. Pumpkin pie side by side, and you can't hardly tell the difference other than a little bit of texture difference. If you use the same spices, so it's sort of the same thing. It's not the pumpkin or the sweet potato that's given the flavor; it's the spices.
Sure. And I'm kind of counting on that. You guys know that my background, my expertise is really in the metheglins. I'm going to throw a little bit of pumpkin flavor in there just to give it that right hint of pumpkin.
Well, here's what you want to do. Just go to the store and buy yourself one of them cans of, just pure pumpkin, not the stuff you make in pumpkin pie. This is just a pure pumpkin. It's untouched, whatever.
Yeah.
And just take a spoonful. Get a big, like a big soup spoonful, okay, and chew on that for a while and see how you like that. I guarantee you, if you don't like pumpkin pie now, you will never like pumpkin pie after doing that.
Yep.
Because it doesn't taste anything remotely close to anything that you've had around Christmas time or Thanksgiving. I guarantee it. And that was a shocker.
A psychology.
Yeah. Well, that's
psychology. You put a picture of a pumpkin on the label and you call it pumpkin whatever, but then you just put the spices in, you already planted the seed in their mind that this is pumpkin. And when they taste the flavor, they're going to say, yeah, it does.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, you take, for example, the pumpkin spice latte, that is the ubiquitous fall item these days. 90% certain that is almost all the spices and it's has little to no pumpkin flavor whatsoever.
Yeah.
The only reason I'm only 90% certain on this is because I can't bring myself to drink one.
Well, when I put three cans of that pumpkin in my beer when I made my pumpkin beer, and I got brave. Now this is a guy who does enjoy, a nice pumpkin pie. But I got brave, and I just took a big spoonful and stuck it in my mouth. And I thought, oh, my God, what have I been eating for the last 50 years? It doesn't taste anything like what you think it might taste like. So get that right out of your head right away. It is not the pumpkin pie that you think it is. So, Ryan, but have JD, you done any?
You know, you may have a good alternative there for adding creaminess to a meat that you're making. The same way that I use a banana to add body. Maybe that's what you do when you want to increase creaminess.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see why not. Ryan, have you done anything with the pumpkin at all?
No, I carve jack-o'-lanterns with the kids every fall.
Yeah, that's as far as you've gotten with the pumpkins. we're laughing because I'm not going to go through the whole story, but I put this pumpkin project together sometime back, and it just absolutely went south. But
oh yeah, I started listening to that on the old show. What happened to it? Was that that turned into a dream?
No, it's coating the lining of the sewers all around Los Angeles. So.
Yeah, JD started his Mead broadcasting career with a big pumpkin disaster.
Yeah.
And that will follow him his whole entire broadcasting career.
Well, maybe JD, you should stick to the jack-o'-lanterns like me.
Yeah. And I don't have any kids, so. But, well, good luck with the pumpkin thing. I want to hear more about it, as we go along. So, keep us tuned up as to what you're doing with that pumpkin deal.
Sure.
Ryan had, and again, welcome to the show, Ryan. You had some ideas, we're still haven't, we're kind of in the final stages of this Braggot thing. I thought my kit was going to be here today, but it's not. Apparently, it's going to be here tomorrow. But you had some ideas on Braggots as well, so I'm going to turn it over to you for a little bit.
Sure. So, first of all, I'll go to the supplies or the kit that I'm working off of here. Northern Brewer, you've all talked about it. You know, I chimed in on it, as having the benefit of it being local for me. Northern Brewer is partly owned by an investment company, and the investment company also owns another company called Midwest Supplies.
Oh,
now,
really?
Now,
I've
this
heard
is,
of them.
Yeah. Now, this is a good secret as well. And Aaron, I think you're in Mequon, aren't you?
I am. Yep.
Yeah. I think they've got a Milwaukee location as well. If you ever want to go out there. Now, I'll also tell you guys, I'm not affiliated or paid or anything by these guys. I'm just a fan of the store, and they've got what I think is the steal of the beer kit universe, and if. You guys check it out. It's called Beer, period, Simply Beer. And they're kits. They're 5-gallon kits, and they're $19.99.
Oh, wow.
Now, I've checked out the ingredients. I bought three of them. They come in about six different styles. I bought three of them. I bought the stout, the IPA, and the American wheat. I actually broke down everything that comes inside of the IPA kit, and if you were to buy that on an individual basis, it'd be about $40 worth of stuff that you're getting in this box that costs, $20. So anyway, that's my secret for everybody to go check out the Midwest Supplies, the beer period, Simply Beer. And it's great because if you screw it up or if you want to tweak it, there's you're not investing in a $50-$60 kit that you're working with. So I I'm going the stout route, I believe. with the Braggot. The kit comes with a quarter pound of roasted barley and a quarter pound of chocolate malt. I think you guys already know I'm gonna cold soak, cold steep those. It comes with 6 pounds of dark malt extract and 1 pound of dark dry malt extract. I think I'm gonna set the 1 pound of dry malt extract aside. I'm gonna use the 6 pounds of the malt syrup, and I'm gonna set the 1 pound aside. And I'm going to replace that with some honey, and I'll get to that in just a second. It comes with 1 ounce of cluster hops that it recommends a 60-minute boil on, 1 ounce of Cascade hops that it recommends a 20-minute boil on. It's the Cefal USO5 yeast, and then it's got 5 ounces of priming sugar for bottle carbonating. You know, I think I am going to do, I at first was thinking, before last week, and I couldn't be on the show, but I listened to the podcast the next day. I was originally just going to do a couple of pounds, and I was going to technically make a honey beer. But after the great, persuasion of all of you guys on last week's show, I decided to go all out. So I'm going to do the 6 pounds of dark malt extract. And then I'm going to do 6 pounds of honey, and I'm going to caramelize the honey first. And I'm going to—I know you guys have done pressure cookers, you've done crock pots. You know, whenever I do it, I just get out my 5 gallon cat, my 5 gallon pot, and I put it on the stove and I stir it that way. And I'm going to—that's how I prefer to do it. You know, I can. It goes quicker. I can, you know, reduce some of the moisture out of it. And then being that I'm going to boil, I'm going to go right to that. So the process I think I'm going to do is I'm going to caramelize 6 pounds of honey. I'm not exactly sure how dark I'm going to take it. I'm going to take it until I get to about, that marshmallowy, smell from it, which, you know, on 6 pounds, it's probably 40 minutes or so. And then I'm going to add, the water, some, at least a few gallons of water, that's 6 pounds of dark malt extract, and then start the 60-minute boil for the cluster and the 20-minute boil on the Cascade. And then when I put it in the fermenter, when it gets, you know, below 105 or so, I'll add the cold soaked tea, I guess we'll call it, yeah, from the roasted barley and the chocolate malt. Now, when I've done the calculations on this, it's going to give me an original gravity of somewhere around 1.095, on a 5 gallon batch. Now, you know, it depends on how much you can coax that USO5 yeast down. You know, I mean, I've heard people have said it gotten stuck at 9. I've heard folks say they've taken it all the way to 13. It really depends where it's gonna go. But let's just say it gets around to that. I don't know. Let's just call it 10-15. That's gonna get to about 10% ABV. Then, not to stop there, because you know, again, we're starting with $20 of ingredients. Why not go big, right?
Sure.
I
like what I'm hearing so far.
I thought about in secondary, tossing in a vanilla bean and some toasted coconut, and seeing if we can bring out, hopefully we can retain some of the marshmallow flavor from the honey. We already know the best way to make a coffee meat is by using chocolate malt anyway. And, that's a joke for everybody.
That's not funny at all.
a little bit of vanilla and a little bit of toasted coconut, and see if we can make something smooth that should end in about the gravity range of a sweet stout.
Just for that comment, you're going to have to drink all of our coffee experiments.
I'll pour them on ice cream and put them in the blender.
yeah, there you go.
Man, that sounds, wow, that sounds good.
It does sound good, man. That toasted coconut, like the sounds of that.
Now, do you toast your own coconut, or you buy it already toasted? I mean, when I'm thinking toasted coconut, I'm thinking of that all that sugar-coated stuff you eat right out of the thing. Are you talking about just raw toasted coconut at that point?
Exactly. I'm going to go to, you know, Whole Foods probably and get some good, you know, raw organic coconut and toast it up myself. Now, part of the reason I want to toast it up, of course, is to get rid of that oil. Sure. But then also to kind of enhance that flavor and bring out, you know, a little more of what I think is going to go well in a stout.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I think this is going to turn out very nicely for you, Ryan.
Well, if it does, you'll all get a bottle. And if it doesn't, you'll all get two bottles.
I love that.
So what's your plans after? Are you going to keg it, or are you going to leave it still, or?
Well, you know, I think that I'm going to throw some on nitro, and then I am going to bottle carb some of it and have it that way.
Okay, so you know, I got this Blickman beer gun the other day, and I went back over to Keg Connection, and you know, Ryan, you got me looking after that one night you called in. Now you got me looking at nitro bottles. So,
well, you won't be able to bottle condition it if you have residual sugar. So,
you know,
no.
Yeah, you got that's a good point, Chris. Yeah, it's going to have to all be kegged at that point, or it's that brings up another good question when it comes to the yeast tolerance. Because let's say, now this, I'd have to do some good experimenting, but let's just say that it got to, 10, 15 or so, and the yeast was reaching exhaustion. What I've done in the past is tried to throw some in a plastic bottle and you kind of see where it, how many days that, It continues to carbonate by the pressure put on the plastic bottle. And then I've been too scared to do it more than once, but then trying to stove pasteurize and kill off the yeast at, and I forget what temperature it is, but almost the way you can.
Yeah, 160 degrees.
Yeah.
170 degrees for... I think it's 15 minutes or something like that. That's a dangerous way to go, though, for most people. I would, and that's why we brought up the issue a couple shows back about, you know, get a kegging system. They're cheap. They're not that expensive. They're easy to use. And you'll find yourself, once you get it, you'll be carbonating everything. And you're not limited by final gravity as to what you can make. So if you don't have a carbing system, then you're relying on bottle carbing, then all you can do is make bone dry stuff and stop shy of the limit of the yeast. But if you've got nitro, I can't imagine why you would want to mess with it anyway. I mean, put it on nitro.
Yeah, I just meant more for – I like having some that's mobile as well. You know, if it's in the Nitro system, it's at my house. If it's bottled, you know, I can share it a little more easily.
Well, JD might get you a Blickman for Christmas.
Yeah. Well, I haven't even used the darn thing yet, but I might be able to rent it out.
Yeah. Well, if I don't get everything on my Christmas list, I may have to contact you about renting it.
Well, it sounds like Ryan, man, you got a good thing going there, man. And like I said, after that, you know, after that last time you called in, you were talking about that Nitro, and we kind of got into a discussion about that. I went right out. Keg Connection was looking at a Nitro setup. So, you know, because my wife loves, I mean, she loves her porters and her stouts. And that seems like the way to go, you know, for those styles of beers. So,
Well, don't discount leaving it still either. I still believe that Braggots can be still. I don't know how well it's going to work with the one I'm going to do, but I'm all for tasting it and see how it is before I go worrying about carbonating it. So
yeah, I did a similar poor Boucher Braggot a few years back that I've mentioned countless times on the show. It is still because I don't have a kegging system. And I took that yeast to tolerance and then some. I still think it's fantastic. Still, it's a great drink. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I would love to try it.
I think there's plenty of room. Yeah, I think there's plenty of room for still Braggots as well. So we're not really trying to conform to what we think of as a beer style. Not 100%. So. You've got some leeway there, especially if you end up with something that's got some residual sugar and it's kind of creamy and heavy-bodied enough to support itself without carbonation, then I see no reason to not leave it still.
Yeah, it's lots of experimenting on the back end there. You know, that's something I typically like doing. I one of the things I'll do with just about anything is I like making a 5 gallon base batch, and then taking, or 5 or 6 gallons, and then, you know, breaking that off into 5 or 6 1-gallon batches to do different things with, either in secondary or beyond. So that wouldn't, you know, I've got a lot of different size, carboys and, yeah, I think I could bottle some up, or have some still and see what that's like. And if it does need carbonation or if it is good, kind of as is.
Well, I had my fill, I've always wanted to do beer, and I did my first beer. That was that pumpkin thing that I did, and I didn't have a choice. I had to put it in bottles. So it was, you know, do the priming sugar thing and boil the water and all that. And oh God, that's just such a pain. And then when you're done, you got all these bottles everywhere. And I thought, you know, the next time I do this, I should just put it in a keg. So, I started looking around, put a kegerator together, and told my wife that we absolutely needed to have a kegerator because I was going to make her favorite beer. And that's what got me the keg set up.
One question, JD.
Yeah.
Have you made her beer yet?
Oh, yeah. Oh, she's been drinking it. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, she's been drinking it. Absolutely.
You know,
that's part of the deal. When you use those excuses to get things, you have to actually carry through.
Oh yeah,
with the promise. So.
Yeah,
JD, I think you just hit on the perfect way for me to convince my wife to get me a kegging system for Christmas here.
There you go.
she hates the empty bottles that are constantly like cycling through our household whenever something gets filled up and bottled, and then, you know, company comes over and drinks it and all. And by God, she's just like, there are so many empty bottles. What the hell, Jeff? Find somewhere to put these. Blah blah blah. Well, honey, if we get a kegging system.
Well, when you when you guys bottle, what's are you using 12-ounce bottles?
Of course. Yep. Beer bottle.
I got rid of those, and I started using 22s. Those, you know, depending on where you are in the country, they're called 22s or bomber bottles. You know, those those bigger guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, Jeff, and anybody listening, that's a really good approach. When you're if you're trying to get this for Christmas, they're not expensive. For the cost of a couple pairs of socks and some ugly sweater that you don't want to wear, you know, you can get your kegging system and you avoid the socks and underwear and sweaters.
Yep.
And it's less problem for her to get. And here's the good thing. If you call Northern Brewer or Midwest Supply or somewhere, you can actually speak with someone. And you don't even have to look online, and she doesn't have to ask you questions and try to sneak around and find out right. what it is you want exactly. She can just talk to the people who know what they're doing, and they'll set her up.
Yep.
And all she's got to do is give them a credit card number, and you're set. It's her shopping simple. Is done. Her shopping for you is done. One quick phone call.
That's it.
And you avoid the ugly sweater and all that stuff.
Is that how you're going to get that $12 bucket of yours?
I don't know how I'm going to get that.
Well, geez, guys, I think we all ought to, like, Secret Santa here, and, like, we'll all chip in $3 and get Chrissy for Christmas.
I'm thinking about skimming funds off the top somewhere. And, you know, like when she sends me to the grocery store for something, I can say, man, the price of that went up, and, you know, skim about $3 off. And after a few times, I'll have enough for a fermenter.
There you go.
You'll be good to go after just a few short weeks.
One of the, you know, as long as we're talking about Christmas, you know, one of the things that, you know, I don't just make wines and beers and meads here at the house. I make you know, fruit cakes every once in a while. I make jams and jellies, and you know, my wife's got a regular. I mean, even my tomato sauce. Last a couple of weekends ago was tomato sauce weekend here. I made 5 gallons of tomato spaghetti sauce and meatballs and sausages and everything went in it. But my wife's got like a just regular route. Okay. I mean, she takes my stuff and gives it to all her friends and stuff. And I sometimes, you know, I guess it's okay. But sometimes I really don't want her giving my stuff out because I don't know how people are going to take it. I mean, my jellies and jams aren't the traditional, you know, I make like a Chardonnay jelly with a sprig of rosemary in it. I'll take a bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon and turn that into a jelly over, you know, over some cheese. You know, my peach jelly usually has a shot of bourbon in it before I'm done. So, you know, so I'm a little leery about, you know, passing some of this stuff out to different people because I don't know how they're going to take it. You know, even my meads and wines and stuff. How do you guys approach this? You know, do you have any fears of turning loose of your stuff at Christmas time? And, you know, Jeff brought up another interesting thing, you know, talking about packaging. How do you package it all up, you know?
You know, I was in beautiful River Falls, Wisconsin last weekend for a wedding. And I gave, as part of the gift, I gave the couple a bottle of 2015 vintage semi-sweet traditional. And you know, I have no problem giving it because, you know, I know the people pretty well who I'm giving it to. As far as packaging, you know, I printed off a little sheet of paper, kind of, you know, about the history of the word honeymoon and how that applies to mead. And, you know, my wife said, you know, and JD and Chris and Jeff, you guys had the pleasure of, talking with my lovely wife a couple weeks ago for a minute. She said, "What are you doing?" I just printed off a sheet of paper and I was going to put a rubber band around it, stick it to the bottle and say, "Here you go."
total guy thing, right?
Yeah. No, she,
I don't even know if I'd even have printed it out on, I probably would have wrote it out in pencil and scotch taped it to the bottle.
Yeah. No, she printed, got some packing tape out, you know, and covered the label over, you know, the sheet that I had printed over the bottle, and then got some ribbon and tried to pretty that up, you know, by doing like some sort of a crisscross pattern across the bottle, and it looked really good. You know, I'm going every year. We get invited to a handful of Christmas parties that do these kind of gift exchanges where every person brings a gift and there's kind of a, you know, you cast lots basically to see who gets which gift kind of a thing. And I plan on putting, bringing a couple of bottles of my stuff to each one of those. I usually bring a bottle or two to open and drink and share there. And then a couple of bottles that have ribbons on them to, add to the gift pile, and it's a great way to get rid of the stuff you don't like. I'm kidding.
Aaron, do you make a habit of gifting out your stuff during the holidays?
I do. I've definitely got a habit where the past few years I'll bring down some meads and sample them with the family and friends and stuff over the holidays. I will say in general, my beers have gone over better with that audience. But as we've talked about on the show, I think with some of the recent improvements that I've made to my mead making process, I'm hoping that the mead starts to get some better results as well. But definitely it's always fun to bring stuff down and share it. In terms of labels and things like that, I usually, you know, we'll just kind of not even go that route and just give 12-ounce bottles, brown beer bottles. But on some occasions, I have done some labels. There's a website out there, and the name is escaping me. Actually, my parents got me a gift card to this where you can go and kind of design your own beer bottle labels, which has worked out pretty well. And then even just like envelope stickers that you would get at like an office supply store, I've used those as well, where you can kind of come up with your own design on your computer and print labels that way. So those are some nice alternatives. That second method is certainly less expensive than the website.
Chris, I know that you've hand out your stuff pretty regularly too. Any fears about what people are going to think, or are you just surrounded by a bunch of alcoholics? Like,
yeah, I've shared
that don't care
with my friends that I know what they like, so it's not really a problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. The first time that I ever thought about giving some as a gift, I was actually sitting at my desk at work, and I was thinking, now how can I label this stuff and make it look nice? And I happened to look down at my desk, and I had my prescription pad laying there. And
there you go.
I said, I'm going to use my prescription pad and make labels. So I just, on the way home when I left the hospital, I grabbed a prescription pad and I used gelatin in hot water and affixed them to the bottles. But then, you know, like 2 days after I gave them away, I realized that my prescriptions have my DEA number on them, which you don't really want to be giving that away.
Yeah,
so basically what I did after that was to print up some mock prescriptions of it that didn't have my DEA number on them. And that's how I label mine. And I just handwrite every one of them as to what it is, you know, kind of personalize it a little bit.
See, if that was any of my friends and I was a doctor, they'd try to take that and say, hey, my doctor said I had to have this bourbon.
Yeah, when I realized that it had my DEA number on it, I decided I probably better go round those up. So I made sure to account for all of them.
But you don't have a fear of people tasting your stuff. I mean, I guess there's a level of confidence that you really have to have in your mead making and beer making, that kind of thing. I guess to be able to trust yourself to give it away.
It's something called DGAS. It's DGAS.
Yeah.
That stands for don't give a shit.
There you go.
Now, if they like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. And so, you know, what they say is the thought that counts anyway. So.
See,
well, yeah.
I hear you guys talking about, you know, what people like and do you think, you know, people will enjoy it and that kind of thing. I think that's the wrong approach altogether. We've all said, we make stuff we like and, you know, and we make stuff that we want to drink. And, you know, with the exception of the world's third best mead maker over there, I don't know how many of us are in competitions, but I purposely give out the worst possible stuff I make. And the reason I do that is when people find out you make beer and wine and mead, they bother you all the time. They want your stuff. They want to taste your stuff. Yeah. They harass you to make it for them. And if you give them the worst god-awful mistakes you've ever... JD, you should have kept that pumpkin stuff and bottled it up. And
I love this guy.
Every time somebody asked you about your beer, you should have handed them a bottle, and they would have stopped bothering you altogether.
I love this guy. Oh, my God, Ryan, where have you been?
It doesn't work when they're alcoholics, though. They come back and say, hey, can I have some more of that?
Well, I know what he's talking about because, like, I mean, I'm the cook in the family, and I mean, I've been canning jams and jellies for a long time. My spaghetti sauce thing—it's an annual thing for me. I make big batches of stuff and I can it all. And like I said, my wife's got this. I mean, she might as well have like a delivery route. You know, she takes the stuff to work, and then, you know, around the holiday times, people are always asking her, "Hey, is JD making any more fruit bread or?" Is he making any more jams? Boy, that peach jam was sure good. And then I get to feeling bad. And I got to go get 100 pounds of peaches and go through all that, you know. But, Jeff, you sent us all a label that was really amazing looking.
Oh, yeah. So this is a shout-out to Eric Bosick. You know, one of the first episodes of this show, we talked about my hibiscus chamomile mead.
Yeah.
That placed at Mazur's Cup. And Eric faithfully went and created this recipe for himself, and he did a gorgeous job of packaging this thing together. It has we should put that on the website, but it has a rose color like shrink for the top of the bottle. The label came out absolutely gorgeous. It has this kind of Art Nouveau, Alphonse Mucha inspired artwork to it, and he did a bang up job putting this packaging together to make this really look good. The only time I have put that much effort into making sure, you know, my stuff was that nicely packaged was the bottles we prepared for the wedding. And I'm going to throw out a pitch to a company here because I was sincerely impressed with their service. Bottlemark.com.
Bottlemark.
Yep. They did all of the labels for our beers and our meads. Nice vinyl labels, completely waterproof. Very, very durable. Like we actually have several of them that we peeled off bottles and they've been really great quality. The customer service was fantastic. The price was almost like half what their nearest competitor was charging. I cannot recommend these guys enough. They were fantastic for us.
Bottlemark.com.
Yep. They do one size of custom vinyl labels and they do custom beer bottles. Okay. So the selection is a little limited, but oh my God, were they a treat to work with. The product came out fantastic. You know, I was completely thrilled with it. Because the idea that we came up with here was that, you know, we were going to make beer and wine for the wedding, but we wanted people to be able to take the empty bottles home as kind of like a souvenir or a memento of the occasion. Sure. And, you know, our parents and several of our close friends did. So that in that case, it was important to have a really nice presentation. And in, so to make all these different labels, I took our engagement photos and I did a really nice like Photoshop job of putting some pretty text over it to talk about like, you know, the whatever the name of the brewer was and ingredients in it, the ABV, and put the date of the ceremony on it and all this, you know, all that important information.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really came out great.
I don't have my email up and I don't know whether if you put the guy's name in the email that you sent out. But if do me a favor, send me an email because I'm gonna include that when I put the podcast up tomorrow. I'm going to include a copy of that label in the podcast post so that people can actually see what it is you're talking about. But, yeah, that was an absolutely gorgeous label.
Yeah, he did a fantastic job with it. As far as giving my meads or my beers as a gift, I have some kind of general rules for my process. I generally don't give it as a gift unless I know it's something somebody's going to like. If they've had it before, they appreciate it, I know it's going to be a really easy gift. Generally, when I'm giving meads, it's one of two occasions. I'm either bringing them to a party or a gathering just kind of to share. It's not as much a gift as just like something I'm doing to kind of treat everybody. Or else I always bring something, that I've made to a housewarming party. Yeah. It's kind of a way to say, hey, from my house to yours.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Hey, and JD, for those people out there who want to make their own labels, since we're all about sort of a DIY thing.
Yeah.
Knox gelatin is a really good way to affix your labels to your bottles in a way that they're easy to get off. You take about a tablespoon of Knox gelatin and get your water boiling, and you want to put in for a tablespoon of gelatin, I think it's, oh, geez, I can't remember now. You start out with like a quarter cup, mix it in, and you just keep adding a little water until it's sort of like a runny gel. Yeah. So you'll have to experiment. I don't really have a set amount. I just sort of do it by eye. But the only important thing is that you need to print your labels with a laser printer. Inkjet will run and get everywhere. A good laser printer, print out your labels and you can put them on with the gelatin. And now the good thing about the gelatin is as long as that label is in cold water, the label will stay on. You can put it in a cooler, an ice chest, or whatever, and it'll stay on. But when you get ready to remove it, you run it under hot water, or just put it in a pan of hot water, and it'll come right off with no residue, and you can reuse the bottles.
Yeah,
so
good idea.
Little DIY there.
Yeah, that's a great tip.
I generally, I usually print my own labels, but I've got an inkjet printer. You know, it's a really good one. Prints, you know, beautiful photographs even. But I use Avery. Avery's got a wine label out there that I use, and I've made several, and I've put them up on my Facebook deal. I don't know if you guys have ever seen them. The last one was the Shiraz that I made, and they're all handmade, homemade, or whatever you want to call it, DIY. Generally out of photographs that I've taken. The Shiraz was a, you know, one of the requirements in going to North Carolina this summer was the fact that my wife, you know, wanted to make it a point that she had to put her feet in the Atlantic Ocean. So I said, well, let's kill two birds with one stone because I'd like to get a sunrise. And so we went out to the beach at 5 o'clock in the morning, and she got her feet wet in the Atlantic Ocean, and I took about 150 pictures of the sunrise. So, but, you know, coming up with your own packaging is kind of a fun thing to do. I'm just, you know, like I say, I don't really mind giving the stuff away. I just, you know, I don't know. Part of me says, nah, you know, really don't want to do that. But the other part of me says, well, you know, you might be making somebody happy. And, you know, people, you know, it pleases me when they ask my wife, hey, is your husband going to be making more jam or more this or more that? But it's just sometimes it can be a pain in the ass, but.
Yeah, the only other issue I would bring up about gifting things that you make like that is to make sure that you put on the label that, you know, that it does contain sulfites or, you know, anything that you put in, sulfites and sorbates, put it on the label, and it wouldn't hurt to even mention it once they open the gift. And of course, if they drink commercial wines and things, they probably already know that they contain those, because almost all of them do. But it's a good thing to let people know just in case they have an allergy or something.
Yeah, I guess, to really nail it down, I have more of a problem giving my stuff to people that I don't know. I don't mind so much giving it to friends and relatives, people that I do know or have known for, you know, for some time. But, you know, a lot of the folks that my wife deals with, I don't know them from Adam. I mean, you know, a lot of people that my wife works with, you know, but they're consistent friends. I mean, they're coworkers that she's been with for many years, and she knows them. I just don't know them. So, but, at any rate, geez, guys, I think we've pretty much come to the end here tonight. As we cue the music up, I guess we'll get together next Tuesday night. More to come. Probably get a little bit more into the Braggot thing as we start to really put our final touches on it. I've got a very good idea what I'm going to be doing with mine, actually brewing the same recipe side by side, one a Braggot, one a beer. Just to do some comparison. But and then Ryan, sure glad you're a part of the show, but I don't know where you've been, but you certainly got a permanent seat here at the table, that's for sure.
I'll be back.
There you go. So with that, from all of us here at the Mead House, we'll catch everybody next week. The podcast, it'll be uploaded tomorrow morning, as always. So be looking for that. So with that, 9 o'clock, Tuesday night. We'll see you next week.